In the last days of his life, Diane Rehm's husband, John, begged her to help him end his life. John was witty and elegant and wise, but his Parkinson's disease had stripped him of his dignity, and he wanted out. His doctors couldn't help speed up the process legally. Neither could Diane. And it frustrated her, made her wonder, for people who have really reached the end of their lives, why can't they die on their own terms? It's actually something she's been turning over for a very long time.
In December of 1955, I was just 19 years old. My mother was 49, lying in a hospital and begging to die. She had some kind of liver disease, which has never been made quite clear to me. But as a teenager in Alexandria, Egypt, she had malaria. And whether, in fact, that affected her liver later on, who can know? In any event, I was there the day before, and it was New Year's Eve. My husband and I had just moved into a brand new apartment building, and all of a sudden, a knock. It was my then husband's brother telling us to rush to the hospital. We kept going so fast, and I was hoping police would catch us and then help us get to the hospital in time. When we got there, I just ran out of the car and ran across the parking lot. But I got there 20 minutes too late. When I got there, my sister, my father, my aunts were all weeping. My mother was still in the bed, but she had died 20 minutes earlier. She died begging to have her life end. She had had so much fluid drained from her body, time after time after time. She really did not want to live anymore. From that early experience, I felt as though no one should have to live suffering. No one should have to live beyond a point where they knew they were going to die, and yet somehow doctors, through medication, through some sort of treatment, were extending their lives. My poor mother was just begging to die. And finally, she did. I shall never forget walking into that hospital room and seeing her in the same house coat she wore the day I was married. It's quite a vivid memory in my mind.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Diane Rehm had been working out all of these personal questions about death, and she'd come to be committed to these death with dignity or medical aid in dying laws being passed in states around the country. But as you may know, she was also the host of a popular public radio program where she tried to maintain some distance and objectivity. And her new book is not unlike her show. It's a collection of interviews with doctors and clergy, patients and their families. It's called When My Time Comes. And while Diane talked about this issue on the air from time to time, it wasn't until she retired in 2016 that she says she felt she could speak freely about the Right to Die movement.
You know, when I was doing the daily radio program and talking about medical aid in dying, you're absolutely right. I always had on different voices from my own. However, while I was doing the show, executives from NPR did not like what they heard, and an entire contingent of them came up to WAMU, my station, where I've been for more than 40 years, saying that if I were to do any further discussions on medical aid in dying, I would have to identify myself as someone who is totally in favor of medical aid in dying. In other words, I could not be neutral.
Yeah.
I'd have to say how I felt. And frankly, I feel I had done that in every situation previously, but they felt I had not made it clear enough. So now, doing my twice-weekly podcast right here at WAMU and having written my own books about this issue, I am free to talk in any way I choose about medical aid in dying, or as some like to call it, death with dignity.
I wanted to ask you, we'll dig into some of the conversations you had that you include in the book here as we go. But after all of the conversations that you've had over the years, what do you figure is at the heart of all of this? This concern that no human being has the right to hasten a person's death. That seems to be the one taboo that comes up all of the time, that we have to just let this nature play out, that we can't have a hand in this. I mean, what's at the heart of the reluctance? What's the obstacle at play, do you think, that you've found?
Well, I do believe that a great many people feel that God should be the only decider.
Yeah.
And if they believe that, I support them. And that's how it should be for them. Other people say, I want absolutely everything that medical science can provide. I support them as well. But I, for myself, want to be able to know that when the time comes, I will have had two doctors certify that I am within 6 months of death. Then I will be provided, after a conversation, a private conversation with one of those doctors who certifies that I am not being pressured, that I am of sound mind and making my own rational decision, then and only then will I be given medication that I must be able to self-ingest so that there is absolutely every precaution taken, that no one is pressuring me, no one is putting any kind of pressure on me to say, Diane, you ought to go now. It is going to be my choice. It is going to give me great comfort to know that I will not be suffering at the end of whatever illness takes me, and that I will have my doctors and my family's support in the meantime. Doug, I am really hoping with this book and with the documentary that will come out next spring that people will begin to talk with their families about exactly what it is they want at the end of life. Death and the subject of death is indeed the last great taboo.
Yeah.
People don't want to talk about it because there is so much fear and anxiety about it. I believe that death is part of life. And when my husband was on the verge of death, he said to me, I'm looking forward to the next journey. He believed what I believe, which is that somehow life continues in some way, but totally transformed. So I don't fear death. I do fear suffering. I don't want my children to see me suffer, or my grandchildren, one of whom I spoke with very intimately for this book.
Yeah.
And I want the comfort of knowing that when my time comes, I can go peacefully.
It's interesting, in a conversation you had with Reverend William Lamar, he said, we'll come back to that a little bit later in the conversation, but he told you we live in a culture that seems to hide from mortality. You think that's right? Does that get to what you were saying about the taboo that we feel of death?
It does indeed. But, of course, the Reverend Lamar is also a member of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. He is a man who has seen this country and the practice of medicine treat African Americans in some horrible ways. And the mistrust that lingers in the relationship between African Americans and the U.S. government, African Americans, and the medical profession. He did say to me, however, that if he could be assured that African Americans would not be pressured, would be given fair and honest treatment, that he would not be opposed to medical aid in dying. But there is, I mean, you and I both know the statistics about medical care and the differential between what white Americans receive and what African Americans and other minorities receive. So it's really quite something when you think about why African Americans are so reluctant to take on medical aid in dying.
Well, this was the insight, I think, about that particular section, so that this is so much about trust. Because you also refer to the fact that the disabled community seems to feel some hesitation about this question as well, because of how they're treated and about the way they may trust or not trust the institution.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yet, at the same time, Mary Chay, who is the D.C. council member who initially introduced medical aid in dying, which ultimately passed, she told me that half of the community that is disabled feels that they've been left out because of the requirement of self-ingestion. For example, people with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. But now they are finding ways to help ALS patients carry out their own end of life through various means. And ALS patients are the ones who are most using medical aid in dying, because it's such a terrible disease that takes away so much of a person's life.
Diane Rehm, her new book is When My Time Comes. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listeners around Utah depend on KUER for reliable information, updates, and conversation. I'm Maria O'Mara, the executive director of KUER. Our statewide service will continue through this time because we know our news and programming are an essential part of your everyday life. We know because you're listening right now. I encourage you to make a one-time donation, or better yet, become a sustaining member. Contribute to the station at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Diane Rehm is with us today. Since she retired from her public radio program in 2016, she's become an outspoken advocate for the Right to Die movement. Her new book is a collection of interviews that serves as this inquiry about medical aid in dying. The book is called When My Time Comes. I want to ask you about some of the conversations you had. Let's talk about Barbara Coombs Lee. She's president of Compassion and Choices. And she has a moment. It seems like, Diane, everyone has a moment that draws them into this. For her, you mentioned, it was May 19th of 1994, the day she learned Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis had died. Would you talk about that, the idea that there's a moment for a lot of people, the thing that gets them really deeply thinking about all of this?
She had that moment when John Kennedy Jr. came out to announce that his mother had died and that she had done it in her own way, in her own bed, exactly as she had wished. If you recall, she had come home from the hospital a few days before, seeking no further treatment. When she died, she was surrounded by friends and family, and she died peacefully. No one has ever said that she took her own life or that she had assistance from any doctor, but the implication is there. And I think it was that understanding or that inference on the part of Barbara Coombs Lee about which she speaks in her book. And in the film that we have done with her and so many others. I think that those who have chosen medical aid in dying are in no way thinking of this as suicide.
Yeah.
There is a 37-year-old woman, Lori, who lives in California, with whom I spoke. And she said, you know, I have breast cancer that has spread throughout my body. If I had my druthers, she said, I would live until I'm 90.
Yeah.
But I know that's not going to happen. And I do not want my 13-year-old son to see me in agony, as I know I would be at the end. I have been told I have 6 months or less to live. I have the medication I need, and when the time comes, I will use it. Now, what's interesting about that, Doug, is that in the end, she did not use it. She, like one-third of the people who have been given this medication, have chosen not to use it. It is the comfort that they get, the peace that they get from having that medication that helps them to end their days peacefully and quietly, as Laurie did.
Barbara Coomsley tells this story of an 82-year-old woman who did not, she was quite clear about this, she did not want to be resuscitated. But when the moment came after her heart stopped, her advance directive was ignored. And Barbara said that Maria felt as though she had been violated.
She woke up in the ICU after having had a heart attack and having been resuscitated, and was absolutely infuriated that the doctors and the medical professionals in that hospital had violated her wishes. She had made them very clear that she did not wish to be resuscitated, that she wished to be allowed to die. If she had a heart attack or a stroke, she had gone into the hospital with a stomach problem. And in the midst of that was when she had the heart attack. She did not live for a very long time thereafter, but felt betrayed by the fact that her wishes had not been followed. Written statements are not enough. What I hope that this book and this documentary film will do is to encourage people to talk with their families, their doctors, their friends about what they want.
It seems like there is this impulse when it's actually happening. Mom is there on the gurney and she's died, and there's that impulse that loved ones seem to have to want to squeeze one last moment. If you can just get, I think they know, even sort of in their mind, this is not going to last very long, but if we can actually, it seems like such a powerful impulse. And I'm wondering, I guess that's the way you deal with that, is you have that conversation so they can forego that impulse when it actually happens at the moment.
It is to ensure that you have peace at the end of your life. You know, I talked with a palliative care physician who acknowledged that there is some pain that there is some suffering that no medicine can touch. And the idea that you want one or two more moments with that person, that's your own selfishness. I don't fear death. I do regard it as the wonderful circle of life. And I feel that when my time comes, I'll be ready to face it, as my late husband was.
Yeah. I wonder, what do you think is the most powerful obstacle for people in just letting their loved ones pass without unnecessary intervention? Because there's medical technology, there's medical hubris, there's just that sheer emotion, but there's also the religious part, and you deal with that in the book and in some of the conversations. I want to ask you about Father John Tuohy. He's a priest in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, you talked to, and he sort of gives you the official position of the Catholic Church, talked about the dimensions in life, among them this idea that God creates life and that humans don't have the authority to take life, that death is natural, he said, but you have to trust the God of creation to pick that time. Talk a little bit about this conversation that you were having and how religion, this idea of God, comes into play.
You know, Father Tuohy is a lovely man, and I enjoyed talking with him. In no way was I there in the production of this documentary to debate someone's beliefs or someone's preferences. I really went into this wanting to learn and wanting to hear how other people felt about this. And Father Tuohy really turned to his Bible, talked about passages from the Bible, talked about why he believed that God Almighty should be the only way that one leaves this earth. And then at the end of the conversation, Doug, I asked him the same question I asked everyone else in that documentary. What for you would be a good death? And Doug, his answer was exactly the same as mine.
What does that tell you?
It tells me that we would all like to have a peaceful death surrounded by friends and family, a death in which we go quietly, we go peacefully, surrounded by people we love. So I think, though his is a different view from my own in terms of making a choice at the end, his is no different from mine in terms of what he wants for himself at the end.
But it was interesting, though, and difficult, I have to say, to encounter some of the opinions, because one of the questions you asked was, if he would offer last rites to someone who had decided to be part of a medical aid in dying program, he said no.
He said he could not.
Yeah. And you said you thought that was really sad. You asked if this would be considered a sin, and he said a grave sin, because it's the taking of life. So this kind of gives you a sense of, and not just in the Catholic Church, but I'm guessing in other faith traditions, how complicated all of this is.
Well, and most especially in terms of the opposition to medical aid in dying, the Roman Catholic Church has been the most outspoken and has put the most money into defeating state legislatures adopting medical aid in dying. I had a conversation with a delegate in Maryland who was initially opposed to...
No, is this Eric Ludke?
That's it.
Yeah.
Eric Ludke. And he said that he was opposed to it, and then his mother was taken ill with throat cancer.
Isn't that the way it works, Diane? Well, as soon as it becomes really personal, then your perspective is not academic anymore, and it changes in some ways?
Doug, we're all one bad death away from supporting medical aid in dying. And his, watching his mother, who was begging to die, who could barely do anything, she finally got hold of a bottle of morphine and managed to swallow the whole thing, was rushed to the hospital, and finally came out of it. And the doctor told Delegate Ludke, if she did anything like that again, to simply not bring her back to the hospital. Because, he said, it's clear she's going to die, and she wants to die, and there is no point in putting her through all of the treatments or all of the efforts to try to revive her. And she did die a few weeks later, but that changed his view completely. He said, I, as a legislator, should not be telling someone else they can or cannot die. And so he became a convert.
Yeah.
And in fact, introduced the legislation for medical aid in dying in Maryland, which, as I said, lost by one vote last year, but is in discussion again this year, as is a very strong movement going on in New York, in Virginia, in Connecticut. We are seeing a lot of activity toward acceptance of medical aid in dying with all of the precautions I mentioned earlier. And in Oregon, they have had not a single complaint, a single issue brought forward of pressure being placed on someone who wants to end their lives without suffering.
Why do you think things are shifting? Is it because it's becoming more personal? Because the medical technology is now pushing these ages to, as you said, you know, to the 90s? I mean, that seems to be one of the things that came up in the conversation with Barbara, that a lot of this had to do with medical technology not really matching the human element, not being in a person's best interest. So is that one of the reasons you think the ground seems to be shifting?
Definitely one of the reasons. Another reason is that the population is aging.
Yeah.
And the baby boomers are now facing their parents as they age. Parents who may not be in good shape. Parents whose lives are perhaps in nursing homes, who don't have any enjoyment in life, who want to see the end sooner rather than later. I think that these discussions need to begin early. You know, because my mother died at 49, my father died at 62, but only 11 months after my mother, he died of a broken heart. My husband's mother and father, his father at 72, his mother at 92, had each taken their own lives because of medical problems. They did not want to live any longer in the ways in which they were living. If these discussions can take place naturally, as it did in our home around the dinner table, both of my children knew exactly how John Rehm and I felt about death and had been comfortable with it, even though my daughter is a physician and didn't want to see her father go. But in the end, because there was no medical aid in dying law in Maryland, where he was in a nursing home, and because he could no longer feed himself, he could no longer stand on his own, he could no longer care for himself in any way, he said, "I am ready to die." And in the end, he stopped eating, he stopped drinking water, he stopped taking medication. And it took 10 long days for him to die. And I just don't think that that is something anyone should have to go through.
Let's talk about the perspective from the medical community. In the book, you include a number of conversations about that. One of them is with Dr. Catalin Roth, a professor of medicine at George Washington University. Dr. Roth said that it's hard for physicians to break with tradition. Talk about what you heard about what physicians, what the medical community is thinking about all of this.
So many say, "I went into medicine to try to heal. I cannot then be a party to help someone die." And yet, even that idea is changing, Doug, among younger doctors. Mm. I watched a lecture given by a member of Compassion and Choices, one of the medical directors, to a group of medical students at George Washington University. And they were clearly impressed with the idea that doing no harm does not necessarily mean not helping a patient die. Doing harm may actually be keeping that person alive. If that person has reached the end of what he or she knows will be death within 6 months, so why endure that last 6 months in pain and suffering?
You had a conversation with Dr. Lonnie Shavelson, And Shevelson said that this idea of patient autonomy isn't being taught very well or isn't maybe being understood very well in medical schools. Talk a little bit about that, the idea that in medical school, the idea of choice, of a patient having their own autonomy maybe isn't fully developed quite yet.
Well, I think within the last 20 years, more and more of us are no longer seeing doctors as the know-all gods that we used to think of them as. More and more of us are trying to understand, trying to research, trying to clearly put our wide eyes onto what our illness may be. We're more willing to ask questions. We're more willing to ask for a variety of options instead of simply taking that doctor's one piece of advice or one word about what that treatment should or should not be. And I think these younger doctors coming up through the ranks are learning more and more to relate to patients in a different way from that of the older generation. So we are learning that patients do have rights. Patients do have knowledge. Patients do have relatives who are trying to keep watch, to perhaps sit with the patient as he or she goes to a doctor. And by the way, that would always be my recommendation. I went to every single appointment when we first learned that John Rehm had Parkinson's disease. I went to every appointment because I needed to learn exactly what was going on, what kinds of medications he was taking, what to watch out for. Patients themselves sometimes hear only a portion of what the doctor says, perhaps because they are so anxious themselves that they don't always hear clearly. So it's very important always to have someone with you and to hear clearly. And I think doctors are becoming more open and more willing to share both the good and the bad options that are out there, and to be more frank about what more treatments can be done. Some doctors are actually saying, you know, Mr. Smith, I could give you another chemotherapy or another radiation and perhaps give you 3 more months of life. But would you prefer, perhaps, to go home and simply live out your days with your family, enjoying what life you have? Because some of those treatments, Doug, can be worse, make your situation worse. And that's what I hope we can try to avoid by educating people about how they must learn about their own illnesses, and when that time comes, ask whether medical aid in dying is available if that person is within 6 months of death.
Let's talk about this conversation you had with Benjamin, your grandson. It's a conversation where you said, okay, Benjamin, take out your phone, and I want you to record this conversation. Talk to me about this experience. You wanted, why did you choose Benjamin? Why did you choose to have him document this conversation on his phone?
Well, I'm lucky enough, most fortunate enough, to know that my grandson loves to come and visit with me. And he happened to be there while we were filming in my apartment, part of the documentary, which is now the last part of that documentary. I asked his mother, my daughter, first, whether I could speak with Benjamin frankly about this. And she said, absolutely. He was 18 years old at the time. And she said, if he is willing to talk with you about this, it's fine with me. And so he used his cell phone to video me. And then the cameraman had his camera focused on the two of us. But I told Ben that should I develop signs of dementia or Alzheimer's disease, I would want him, his mother and father, and my son, Ben's uncle, and his wife, to make sure that they tell me early on, because I do not wish to live through Alzheimer's. I've seen too many cases, and they are sad. Now, there may be some who suffer from Alzheimer's who live happy, changed lives, but I've seen many who are miserable, and the entire family is miserable because of it. And I don't want to live that way. And Ben was wonderful. I asked whether he would follow my wishes, and he said he would.
You say in the conversation, you mention what you describe as this perfect paragraph you came across from Anne Morrow Lindbergh. Say something about that finally, and what you think is perfect about it.
Perfect about medical aid in dying. I think what's perfect about it is that if you have been deemed within 6 months of death, you can go when you decide to go. And it is comforting to know that you are in control of your own life and the time of your death. And for me, that is what is so important.
Diane Rehm, thank you so much for the time.
Doug, it was great to talk with you again. Take care.
Diane Rehm, her new book is When My Time Comes. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.